You've been hearing of Governor Snyder's declaration of a state of emergency in Flint. That, of course, intended to help the city recover from its drinking water problems. Flint city leaders are thanking the governor for his quick approval of a state of emergency declaration. He signed it yesterday, and Genesee County commissioners sent the request to the governor only the day before. Carrie Nelson is Flint's city council president.
There was a dark cloud hanging over this city, but now I can see beams of light busting through now.
So the next step will be for the governor to ask the Obama administration for help dealing with the drinking water crisis. That could free up tens of millions of dollars to replace aging lead pipes and provide help for people whose health has been affected. It's Current State for Wednesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. These are heady days for General Motors. 6.5 years after emerging from an historic bankruptcy, GM is on the brink of what may be its best sales year ever. Some of that success can be linked to the 2016 Chevy Camaro. This week, the Lansing Grand River Assembly Plant announced it would add 500 new jobs to meet demand for the Camaro. Tonight, GM will unveil its latest electric vehicle. Now, while most of this news is good, GM is also facing legal troubles. A trial due to start in New York next week will determine GM's liability in a series of deadly accidents tied to faulty ignition switches the company knew about for years. Joining me to talk about the ups and downs on GM's road to the future is David Mueller. Mr. Mueller's an automotive reporter for M Live. He is based in Detroit. David, welcome to Current State.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start off with our hometown brands here in the Lansing area. The Chevy Camaro was a long-awaited arrival. There was a lot of excitement when it was announced production would move here from Ontario, but this was in the aftermath of some layoffs in Lansing in 2014. What does this new third shift add to the company and add to the local economy?
Well, obviously, it's great for the local economy, and it kind of came as a little bit of a surprise, which was nice because you mentioned those layoffs in 2014. Everybody kind of knew those were going to be temporary at the time because this return of production for the Camaro coming from Ontario, Canada, was anticipated. But this latest round of firing, which is happening now, about more than 500 people, both hourly and salaried, really kind of came as a surprise, and it was GM saying that, hey, look, our forecasted demand for this new Camaro is so great that we want to get this third shift online in Lansing. So great news for Lansing Grand River Assembly.
Is Lansing's third shift a calculated risk on GM's part, or is it more a show of confidence in projected sales?
Well, you know, the new Camaro's been getting all kinds of accolades, and the outgoing model sales have struggled a little bit, but its rivals, the Dodge Challenger and Ford Mustang, have been selling really, really well. And all signs do point to this new Camaro being a hot seller. Having said that, it does seem a little bit like a calculated risk because obviously nobody knows exactly how well it's going to sell, but all signs point to it being a really big seller. I think the question mark more for Lansing Grand River Assembly would be the Cadillac ATS and CTS models, which are also built there. They both struggled a bit in 2015. Their full-year sales were down by double digits, really. So, and Americans haven't been buying mid-sized cars. So I think that's where some concern should be.
Well, for years, the Cadillac was a high flyer for GM. I mean, this our plant here in Lansing enjoyed growing employment due to the success of the CTS. It was, in a sense, the flagship brand for some number of years. Can the Cadillac come back? What do you know about GM's plans for the Cadillac?
They haven't said much specifically about the CTS and the ATS, and now this is going to be a little bit of speculation. What's not speculation is that they started rebadging the brand with these new nomenclature. Like, for example, the top-of-the-line new sedan is called the CT6, and they're going to roll out that new nomenclature and kind of rebadge, I think, every model. So some speculation would be that maybe they'll do the same with the ATS, CTS. These would be outgoing models. They'll rebadge them as maybe, this is just a guess, like a CT4 or something like that, and that they'll continue building the newer generation models there. I guess that would be the speculation, and that would be the hope. But whether or not GM plans to do that is completely a mystery at this point. They haven't announced anything on that front.
We're talking about General Motors today. We're discussing the company's performance in the last year and what may be ahead in 2016. David Muller is our guest. He's an automotive reporter for MLive based in Detroit. The North American International Auto Show begins next week in Detroit. It's interesting talking about Cadillac here, David, because some of the high-end luxury brands, Bentley, I think Mercedes and BMW and a number of others are not expected to be in Detroit this year. Why is that?
Well, actually, just a quick point of clarification. Mercedes and BMW will be there. It's Bentley, Jaguar, Land Rover, Tesla. These brands are pulling out, and the reason is it seems like they're kind of done with the auto shows. It's not necessarily something against the Detroit Auto Show or anything like that. They kind of stopped doing all the auto shows in the U.S. They see it as, even though these luxury brands, I don't think they really see it as worth their time and money anymore to set up shop, to bring their wares down, and their customers aren't really there.
Does that benefit Cadillac? It seems like that would draw a little bit more attention, at least, to American brands, particularly the Cadillac.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Cadillac, Lincoln, some of these American luxury brands really should hopefully get more attention with the absence of nameplates like Bentley. Even though Bentley's kind of its own kind
True.
Of school of cars there, but yeah, True. I think it would. You know, the less competition and the less other cars to look at, it should benefit Cadillac.
GM is making some new investments in technology as well. It just made a $500 million deal with Lyft, which is a ride-sharing startup that competes with Uber. Now, normally that might be seen as a threat to a car company because it appears to discourage car ownership, but this appears to be different. What's GM's motivation here?
Yeah, it's a really interesting development. Excuse me, it's been happening in the auto industry, and it's really this embracing of shared rides and shared ownership of cars and autonomous driving. It all kind of comes together. If you imagine an urban metropolis in the future where fewer people own cars, and instead they summon them with their smartphones or whatever, and they come and pick them up, and maybe they're driverless, and they take them around. And this is GM really embracing this future thing. They embrace it, and at the same time, giving Lyft a huge lift, for lack of a better term, with $500 million. It was part of a $1 billion funding. And GM gets a seat on their board going forward, too. But it will be really interesting to see how this develops. They said they're going to develop a series of autonomous, a network of autonomous cars that will, frankly, be summoned on demand. But they didn't give a lot of details on that. There's some immediate partnerships, and it really is GM kind of betting on this future of more autonomous cars. Now, just a quick point on ownership. Some people, you know, our readers especially, rightfully so, are kind of leery of some of the stuff like, well, you know, I like driving and, you know, I don't want, you know, a computer to drive me around town. And that really, I think, is quite a ways down the road. There was even a study just really quick that in 2030, 15% of all cars might be autonomous. And I mean, it sounds like a lot, but 85% wouldn't be autonomous. So just a quick point there on that.
Mm. Next Monday, as we said, is the first day of the Detroit Auto Show, but it's also the day another chapter begins in GM's ignition switch scandal that cost a number of lives. It's been reported GM knew about the problem for several years before issuing a recall. Remind us, please, what's the heart of this case next week?
Yes, so this is some outstanding class action lawsuits. There's about a few hundred of them, and they weren't involved in this huge claims resolution facility that GM set up, and that was overseen by Ken Feinberg. He's a really well-known attorney. He handled the September 11 Victims Fund. He handled the BP oil spill and the Boston Marathon. And so GM paid out nearly $600 million in claims with that, but there's still some outstanding class action lawsuits being handled by a judge in Southern New York. And that trial, the judge ruled that this would go forward. It's going to be kind of like a bellwether to say, well, could GM, post-bankruptcy GM still be liable for some of this, for this ignition switch? And it really will be interesting to see what happens with this. Because if in the January 11 trial, GM is held liable, then there's further trials that would happen throughout 2016. So it's a really big deal for the company. And I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens on January 11th.
I mean, the automakers already paid out quite a lot of money in fines and settlements, including a $1 billion fine imposed by the federal government and about $600 million already to claimants. Do the insiders think that more payouts are more likely or less likely?
It could go either way. There's no sentiment one way or the other, but you're absolutely right. GM has put out, they paid a $1 billion fine to the federal government, as you mentioned. Time will tell. Will they pay another $1 billion out? My gut would tell me I doubt it, but so far they've been weathering this. It's been an absolute tragedy. It's been bad for the company, but they've been weathering it, and I would guess that they're going to continue, even if they are held accountable for some more of these liabilities. They've been making money hand over fist recently. They've been very profitable.
Well, that triggers my next question. Why hasn't the ignition scandal dampened sales? We just don't seem to have seen that.
Yeah, I know. It's an interesting point. We haven't seen that. Your guess is as good as mine on that. I don't know. I mean, new car sales are at record levels right now, not just GM, but all the automakers. Yesterday, actually, the records came down. It was a new record. All the automakers announced their full-year sales, and it was a record for new cars sold in the U.S. Last year. Beat the 2000 record, which was about 17 million in 340,000, whatever, and now we've sold 17.4 million. The economy is doing well. People are buying cars. Lending's loose. So it's kind of not just GM, but everybody's selling. There's tons of new cars.
David Muller's our guest here on Current State. David's an automotive reporter for MLive based in Detroit. The Consumer Electronics Show is taking place in Las Vegas. This show has a strong automotive dimension to us. Talk to us about the Chevy Bolt. What is the Bolt all about?
Yeah, this is a really interesting car. It's going to be unveiled today in Las Vegas, probably about 4 p.m. GM CEO and now chairwoman is scheduled to speak, and she's expected to, not even expected to, they're telling us they're going to release this production version of the Bolt EV. It's an electronic car, a little four-door electronic car. It's supposed to get more than 200 miles of range on one charge and also be affordable. It's supposed to be priced below $30,000. After federal tax cuts. So it's become like an everyman's new electric car.
This week, the company elevated CEO Mary Barra to chairman, so now she holds both titles. What's the significance of that, David?
It's quite a historic moment. She was the first female CEO of the company, and now she's also the first chairman of the company, chairman of the board. GM is painting it as kind of an efficiency move. They're saying, look, we're going to be more efficient for her to be the chief executive as well as the chairman of the board. But really, it's also a testament of how she's performed since she became CEO in 2014. If you think about it, I mean, the whole ignition switch debacle, which we talked about, began right after she became CEO, and she's handled that arguably really well. The company's done really well since she's been at the helm. So it's really a testament to how well she's done at the helm of General Motors.
Talk to us a little bit about your job. What it's like. What is it like to be based in Detroit and to cover this legendary automaker? What do you need to know to do your job really well?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess I don't know. You have to first really like cars and really like Detroit, in my opinion. I love both. I've always enjoyed cars. I've always loved the city of Detroit. So to cover a Detroit automaker is really it's a lot of fun, for lack of a better phrase. What would you have to know? I mean, it depends on whether you'd want to know the business side, the engineering side. I lean more toward the business side, so just kind of my experience.
Did you grow up in Southeast Michigan?
I actually grew up over in Grand Rapids. Until I was 18, and then I moved around quite a bit. I went to Paris and worked internationally for a little while, and then was in New Orleans. Actually, in there during the BP oil spill, I worked as a journalist, and I talked to Feinberg a few times, so some knowledge of how he handles those claims and that kind of thing. But then I moved back to Detroit about 3 years ago. Well, not back to Detroit, but I moved to Detroit 3 years. I grew up coming to the city, that kind of thing, you know, but I grew up on the west side of the state.
Well, if you grew up in the Grand Rapids area, you grew up pretty near some GM plants.
Absolutely.
Just one final word on your outlook for GM in 2016. By and large, going to be a pretty strong year for the automaker?
All signs point to it being a strong year for GM and for the U.S. auto industry in general. Consumer confidence is up right now. The macroeconomic, despite what's been happening in the stock market at the beginning of the week, and despite some of these international things, I guess we'll see how the whole North Korea thing hits the market and that kind of thing. But the macroeconomics point to it being a strong year for GM and a strong year for all automakers in the U.S.
David Mullers, an automotive reporter for MLive in Detroit. We've been talking about General Motors, how it did in 2015, and what's ahead for 2016. David, thank you for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Coming up on Current State, the City Rescue Mission of Lansing is a nonprofit that strives to meet the physical and spiritual needs of men, women, and kids struggling with homelessness. Over the last year or so, they've made some changes and expanded their services. We'll speak with City Rescue Mission Executive Director Mark Chris and Director of Men's Ministries Randy Barton to find out how their program has been growing. That and more later this hour on Current State. You've heard of murder mystery shows and scavenger hunts, but in Okemos, there's a new business presenting a twist on audience participation entertainment. And Current State Scott Pohl is here with more on Escape 2020. How does it work?
Well, Mark, to get the most out of going to Escape 2020, you have to work well with others. You've heard the phrase, plays well with others.
Indeed.
It's pretty important here. In fact, for some, there's more than just a social outing going on here. People have to work together in a way that could serve as a team-building exercise for work colleagues. Escape 2020 co-owner Kathleen Fox showed me around. Kathleen Fox, welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell me about the basic premise behind Escape 2020. What's going on here?
The idea is that you get trapped in a room and you have to solve the clues in order to escape the room.
Pretty simple. Now, I understand typically it's up to 8 people at a time. Is that correct?
That is correct. We wanted to maintain a smaller group within the room intentionally for the fact that we wanted to have everyone have an opportunity in order to actively participate in solving and being successful. Too many people in a room, you have too many bystanders and possible watchers. We wanted everyone to feel that internal success of getting out alive.
Ooh, getting out alive. So what's the premise now? You have an hour to figure out the clues and get out. And while you're in there, the door will not open, right?
That is correct. Once you're in the room, the door stays closed. However, we do provide clues while you're in the room. We are monitoring everyone while they're in the room. We're listening. We're observing. If they feel stuck or frustrated, we do pass you a clue. Specifically in the parlor room, which is set in the 1900s, the only way to transmit communication back then was via a telegram. So you do receive a telegram via the old-fashioned U.S. mail postal. In the 1950s room, you receive your clues by the Avon lady via the phone.
And you're planning a third room. We'll learn more about that in a minute. Now, are you envisioning this as being a social thing for groups of friends? Or I also understand that one possible audience is team building, where people who work together maybe would come out and do this together as a team building exercise. Are both of those part of what's going to happen here, maybe?
That is actually correct. There are two paths you can take, one personal and one professional. The personal side is that you can come with friends, enjoy a good moment, learn a little bit about yourself, test your wits, see if you're a sleuth or not. The other side is the professional angle, which is where we do team building, leadership development, cross-communication. That's where a lot of our groups are coming from.
What about finding your way out of a locked room? Is there that would help build a team that works together?
Well, you're transported back in time, so you're not in your work environment. You're out of your comfort zone. And when people are out of their comfort zone and they feel the pressure of a clock ticking, you get a little nervous, and some of our anxiety is raised. Maybe our voices get raised a little bit. We're short with individuals. But the idea is that you're in a safe environment. You're there with your peer group. And at certain times, there's going to be individuals that step up to the plate. And there's other times that where you have to sit back and cross-communicate to ensure that the puzzle you're working on has a possible outcome that's going to help somebody else solve theirs. That forces you to communicate with one another and forces you to work together. So it does really bring a group together.
Have you ever done this sort of thing yourself?
Yes. I've been a scavenger hunt for years. My husband and I had, even our, you know, just for fun, we would have scavenger hunts and create them for our friends. And then we did it for charities. We've also done the murder mysteries at our house where we wrote our own murder mysteries. I'm just a big puzzle clue. I mean, I like to figure out how a magic trick works. I like to solve all those kind of puzzles. And then one day I was driving to work thinking, wouldn't it be fun to do this with my friends in my own house where that we didn't have to get into a car and drive to all the certain places. And I thought that would be a wonderful idea. Then I realized after doing some research, it's already been established and I didn't create the idea myself. So I have gone to others just to see what they do and figure out how I can compare. What I think ours is unique is that we have the themed rooms because we really want you to feel that you are in a different environment. So it forces you to think outside the box.
We're talking with Kathleen Fox about Escape 2020 in Okemos. And I want you to show me the rooms, but I want to ask you, first of all, before we go see the rooms, how much you can tell me about these rooms without giving anything away.
Well, everything in a room could be a clue or may not be a clue. You have to determine that for yourself.
Can you tell me, do the clues have to be solved in a certain order to make the door unlock? Is there that kind of an aspect to it?
No. The rooms are set up differently. The parlor, the Victorian parlor set in the 1900s, works where you have to solve clues and gather things. And when you gather things, those are the final combination. In the 50s room, there are different paths you can take. So many groups can work independently, yet come together at certain times throughout the process because you have to help cross-communicate. So you do not have to solve them in any order, but you do have to solve them, obviously, to get out.
It would be fun to come in costume to do this.
That is a potential. We also have some hats and period outfits that people can wear for their memory picture at the end of the event.
All right. Well, let's go look at one of the rooms. We're going to start with the parlor, okay?
Okay. I'm ready when you are. I've set the fireplace. The fireplace is on.
Okay. Now, we've walked into the room. I hear a little lightly playing music in the background. And the fireplace has a video fire in it with a countdown clock. That's to help the team keep track of where they are in the 1 hour it takes to get out of the room, right?
Correct. Again, we wanted the safety as an issue, but we wanted to have the ambiance because in the 1900s, the way to heat a home was via the fire. So you have the fire, you have period perfect music, and everything in the room, we try to be as authentic as possible to the era that we're trying to portray.
There are some candles on the mantelpiece, pictures on the walls, some period-appropriate furniture and that kind of stuff here. And at some point, a team that came in here would find enough clues to find their way out of the room. Is that pretty close to accurate?
Yes. The pictures on the wall are not only for viewing purposes.
Okay. Very careful. All right, let's go across the hall. And the room across the hall is decked out like a 1950s living room. Tell me about this room.
I think this is the fun room because of the colors and because of the furniture. I mean, everything in here is truly from the 1950s, including the 1950s television that does work. We have a 1950s stereo. We have the 1950s couch, the chair, the lamps. Everything in this room comes with the must and the mold from the 1950s.
You mentioned the colors. It's, wow, the walls are kind of a lime green, and I'll tell you what that lime green reminds me of, sadly. My office is roughly the same color of a lime green. We have a pink shelving unit and vivid, vivid colors here. So a fun 50s era kind of a room for this game.
Even the dishes are from the 1950s.
Each room needs to be reset and cleaned up between groups that might come through.
We do need time in between each group. That's why reservations are required. The way to get to reserve the room is just via the website. And it does, after a room, because people will destroy the room. They will turn furniture over and upside down and look through clues because there are hidden compartments within the room that you need to locate and find.
Now, there's one more room under construction we're going to go into. And this room, we'll have a photo of it, WKAR.org. This is, what are you calling this? It looks like a medieval dungeon.
I prefer that word, but everyone thinks that may be a little too scary. So you might be calling it the Knight's Den. It is supposed to reflect an old medieval dungeon. So we have knights, we have stone walls, and back in that era, we were trying again to be historically correct and accurate. So there won't be any paintings on the wall. They will maybe be carvings or scratches to reveal the way to get out.
I have one last question, and that has to do with the approach of wanting to put together a team to do this, up to 8 people. But what if I think I'm super brilliant and I want to try to do it by myself? Would you let me try to do that by myself if I wanted to?
Oh, sure. We'll let anybody come in and try it. I mean, the idea is to test your wits and your own mental abilities. So we'd love to have you.
I'm not sure I'm really that brilliant to do it all by myself.
Well, what's unique is that for some of the clues, we've had a couple of groups that have been here that were 16 years old. They came in and got it like that. When they were with their parents, the parents sat there and said, I still can't figure it out. So it really depends on your approach. Sometimes we are so stuck in our ways, we can only look at things one-dimensional, when somebody else can come and look at it completely differently. So it does help to have more people in the room because they are going to help you solve things.
Kathleen Fox is co-owner of Escape 2020 in Elkhamas with her sisters, Susan and Regina Griffin. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And Scott, I understand that Escape 2020 is working on a 4th room. Is that right?
That's right, Mark. It's going to be a 1970s disco lounge. That's the one you and I should go check out sometime.
Can't wait. All right. Thank you, Scott.
Sure.
Coming up on Current State, we've got some snow on the ground in mid-Michigan, and it finally feels like winter. It's a good chance to get out and do some wintertime activities like snowshoeing. And Current State's April Van Buren will show us how it's done. That's coming up after the break. We'll point out the Lansing State Journal's reporting that MSU President Luana Simon will attend next Monday's public forum that includes the possible sale of the broadcast spectrum used by WKAR-TV. In a story written by R.J. Wolcott, MSU spokesman Jason Cody confirms President Simon will leave a meeting of the American Association of Universities in Arizona a day earlier than planned so she can be at the forum. At the first forum on Monday, several attendees noted that the president was absent and called on her to attend. The second forum will be held 7 p.m. next Monday evening in the MSU Communication Arts Building here at MSU. President Simon has to decide by the next day whether or not to participate in the Federal Communications Commission auction that could result in the end of WKAR-TV over-the-air broadcasting. It's Current State here on WKAR Radio. Homelessness is a problem faced by many individuals and families. It doesn't have one single solution. The City Rescue Mission of Lansing is a nonprofit that seeks to meet the needs of people struggling with homelessness and help them find the solutions that will work for them. In this week's Neighbors in Action segment, we're checking back in with the City Rescue Mission. A little more than a year after their last visit, there have been some changes at the mission in that time. Joining us back in the studio, Executive Director of City Rescue Mission, Mark Chris, and Randy Barton, Director of Men's Ministries. Mark, Randy, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, remind us exactly what the City Rescue Mission does. What is the bread and butter of its mission and the services that you offer?
The bread and butter is we provide food, shelter, and hope for 105 years. We've been providing those elements of food, shelter, and hope in the Lansing community, Michigan's capital area. And so for over 100 years, we're providing shelter and food and, of course, the gospel. And we're the largest shelter in Michigan's capital area. So we shelter about 150 men, women, and kids every single night of the year.
You are a fixture on Michigan Avenue.
It is an icon that Jesus Saves years. Cross yes, has been there really. For a long time. Yeah.
And what a reminder, listeners, of the changes that you've made over the past year here.
Well, About a year ago, it was kind of theoretical. We created a new dorm. So traditional shelter has been changed in Michigan's capital area. We decided to increase our capacity, but not just increase shelter beds, but community beds, work dorm beds as well. And so we wanted to provide incentive for men to do more to correct the homeless situation they happen to be in. And so as we increased our shelter, we increased opportunities. Community dorm is actually a place where men can extend their stay. So they come to the mission for about 90 days. They can go in the community dorm. They have to contribute 10 hours to 15 hours a week in the community to stay at the City Rescue Mission. Mm. So they get to extend their stay by doing work. And through that process, if they do get work, they can go to the work dorm and spend another 90 days inside the work dorm. So every single time they upgrade their stay, we provide new incentives. So they might get a locker in the community dorm to store their stuff. We'll actually charge their cell phone at night. So in the morning, they have a charged cell phone they can actually use to look for work, by example. And so this whole process was not just, hey, have a bed, but give them some incentive to actually do some work to give back to the community. So after 90 days, they start going to the community dorm, and they start giving 10 or 15 hours a week at the mission or at another nonprofit. And through that process, we actually had about 100 men get work, save their money, and get their own place over the past year. And so it gave them incentive to say, you know, I can do something productive. I saw great joy and utility in these men contributing to the mission, whether they're cleaning the floor or cleaning the chapel or working for another nonprofit. They're doing something constructive in the community. So we didn't want them just to stay with us. We're going to provide more beds. We'll provide more incentive for men to do something productive in the city.
Totally understood. I'm reminded of the state's efforts. I believe Governor Snyder referred to it last year's State of the State address, the River of Opportunity, kind of bundling services together in a way that we take a more comprehensive approach to helping people who need help, not just in Lansing, but in the entire state of Michigan. Randy Barton, do you consider it, is this working in your view?
Oh, it's absolutely working. As we look at the numbers, we increased our bed count significantly with that. And now we see where men used to just simply be in a temporary overflow, about that same number is now in a dorm where they're able to get casework. They're now moving forward. I'd say that nearly 100 men going through the program in 1 year, getting a job, getting their own apartment is certainly signs that it is working. The attitude around the mission as well, just kind of the air of it, is men that were once very hopeless are now starting to find a sense of purpose. They appreciate that someone is believing in them and trusting them enough to help and to contribute, and it's really increased the morale a lot, as we've seen just so many go through and prove it to be successful.
We're speaking with Randy Barton, Director of Men's Ministries at the City Rescue Mission of Lansing. Also, Executive Director Mark Chris joins us. We're learning more about how their program for the homeless has been growing on Michigan Avenue. Mark, you have a second location for women and children. How does it differ from the men's location?
Yes, about 5 years ago, we bought the old Maplewood Elementary School. We put about $2.5 million into the project, and now we shelter about 90 women and kids at that South Cedar Street location. And so it's a ministry for women and children, for families. And so we shelter on average about 90 women and kids every single night at that facility, and about 50, 60 men, upwards of 70 now, mm-hmm. at the men's shelter on Michigan Avenue. So two separate facilities, both part of the City Rescue Mission. And about 5 years ago, when we purchased the building, we bought it for about $200,000 from the school district. And again, we put about $2.5 million into it, and we more than tripled, our, more like quadrupled our capacity for women and kids alone.
Yeah. I want to ask both of you what you feel the root causes of homelessness are. As we alluded to in the introduction, there are a variety of causes, but sure. What I mean, if you had to point to a root cause of homelessness, what would you say it is?
Well, there's no one cause, and I think there's many different reasons, and typically it's financial. My car broke down, I couldn't get to work, I lost my job. Most people are only about two paychecks away from being homeless, and so it's a common possibility for people to become homeless. So I think affordable housing is an issue. Work that allows me to make ends meet is difficult as well.
Anything else to add to that, Randy?
Yeah, you always hear the common stigma of just lack of personal responsibility and not doing what is necessary. And there will always be that element. But we do see a large element of even mental illness, mm-hmm. With several of our guests and things. And so thankfully with the community dorm and the casework they get, we can point them to areas where they may be able to get help that they need as well.
City Rescue Mission of Lansing goes back over 100 years, as Mark pointed out. Randy, at what point did you get involved, and why were you drawn to this place?
I'd been working with the City Rescue Mission as one of their chapel speakers for about 6 to 7 years, and had opportunity to just come on seasonal part-time in a donation driver capacity. And during that, there's opportunity that arose to get even more involved, and certainly jumped at it, as you just see the great work that's going on there. In about 2.5 years now, I've been actually on staff in about 2 years in the director position on Michigan Avenue. And it's just incredible to be able to see the change and transformation of people's lives.
Mark, you didn't get involved 100 years ago. We know that.
Not
but
quite.
How long ago? How
about
long have you been
years ago,
there?
Okay. And similar volunteering to serve a meal. And I started seeing the need for volunteers and consistent need, people coming for meals, not just homeless, but working poor coming for meals. And just seeing how God impacts people's lives, the City Rescue Mission really made an internal impact on their lives and mine. And so from becoming a volunteer to becoming an employee, I just realized that's what I want to do every single day, is be able to help others. And it's amazing to see how God brings people to be able to meet that need in Michigan's capital area.
Very commendable. Randy, does City Rescue Mission have an emergency shelter?
Absolutely. That's been our staple for so long. That's what we had before the expansion, and we still continue to have 38 beds each night, as well as overflow if those get full.
And how does Michigan's winter weather impact the demand at the emergency shelter?
It certainly impacts it. This year being a little milder winter hasn't impacted it quite as much, or maybe it has, but it's lightened up in some areas. But during that, we do have cold weather policies in place to open up that overflow when it does get cold, when it gets blustery, and be able to still continue to help people and even more through the overflow that'll open up.
Mark, how do you feel we as a city or a community or a region, let's say, are doing at addressing homelessness? What might we do more of, let's say?
I think investigate. When the public investigates, you know, how our organization's giving back and how they helping others, we want long-term success and help. You know, I think about giving out, you know, blankets on the street, by example. That sounds like a great thing to do, but we really want the people to get off the streets, not enable them to be on the streets. Mm-hmm. And so I think investigate where you're going to put your dollar, where can you put, you know, bring your food donation. I would encourage people to go to the organization to see what kind of quality help they provide others. The City Rescue Mission, by example, helps people get off the streets and get housing, whether it be families, individual men or women. We want them to correct the homeless situation they happen to be in. We want to be able to share the gospel with them, be able to feed them, do it of quality work. And so I would encourage people, investigate, see what they do, how they do it, and then put your dollar where you want to put your dollar.
Mark, Chris, and Randy Barton are both with Lansing's City Rescue Mission. There are quite a few different opportunities for volunteers at the mission. Can you tell us about a few of them?
Sure. I would say go to bearescuer.com and click on
bearescuer.com.
Bearescuer.com, because everyone wants to be a rescuer. And talk to our volunteer coordinator. Call 517-485-0145. Talk to our coordinator. Find out what's worked for your schedule. But volunteer opportunities would include things like sorting our food basement, sorting and dating cans. Could be serving a meal. Could be an activity, a group activity, maybe in our thrift store. But a lot of different volunteering opportunities. But specifically, meals are pretty popular.
Randy, what would you say you're looking for in a volunteer? Who would be a good fit for the kind of volunteer that you need?
Yeah, first, it'd be somebody that's willing to work with all types of people. And in volunteering, you're going to want somebody that's dependable. Sometimes it's a reoccurring opportunity for them, as well as somebody that's just flexible and a little bit open-minded, of willing to look past what it may be a Hollywood version of homelessness really is. Mm. Somebody that's compassionate and someone that's just able to see a need and meet a need with it.
Is there training involved?
There is. Anyone that comes in, they meet with our volunteer coordinator that will walk them through, would be necessary for whatever capacity they're going to be used.
Well, we've been speaking with Randy Barton, the Director of Men's Ministries at City Rescue Mission, along with Executive Director Mark Chris, about the problem of homelessness and how City Rescue Mission is addressing that, and their exciting expansion and apparent success here over the last year at creating more independence, I guess, is the
Absolutely.
Way we would
we want
put
to give
that.
People opportunities to correct the homeless situation they happen to be in. So to come to a safe place that's going to help them is City Rescue Mission.
Randy, Mark, thank you for joining us. Continued success. Current State's looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, or you can tweet us. At KAR Current State, please tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Well, now that there's finally some snow on the ground, it's starting to feel like January, and that means it's time to get outside and enjoy all your favorite winter activities, and that's exactly what producer April Van Buren did at Fenner Nature Center in Lansing yesterday. I noticed you ducked out for a while
yesterday. Yeah, I took a little mid-afternoon vacation.
I guess so, a little perk up. What'd you do at Fenner?
I actually went snowshoeing for the first time. So Fenner is going to be doing these lantern-guided snowshoe hikes every couple of weeks this winter, starting next Friday. So I stopped by to get a little preview and talk to program manager Jenny Minch about some of the wildlife that visitors might see. And so Jenny started me off with some snowshoe 101.
All right, so for our snowshoes, we have a couple of different parts that you want to know about when you're using them. This big part all around it, on ours it's red, on other ones it can be made of plastic or made of maybe type of plasticized canvas or leather. It's called the decking, and that's what helps you sort of float on top of the snow so you don't sink in. It spreads your weight evenly across the surface. The next part to know is the binding, so they're the straps that hold your feet in and attach you to your snowshoe. We have the pivot point up here under the toe. It allows your foot to step up and down and not be fully attached to the decking while you're walking. Underneath the toe, we have the crampons, which are two just big metal spikes. And so those will kind of grip down into the snow, grip down into the ice, and make sure that we don't slip and slide our way, because there's nothing worse than having two gigantic sleds on your feet and sliding down an icy hill.
All right, well, I am going to try and put mine on. I may ask for your assistance.
Of course.
Now let's see, we've got, is there a right and a left one here?
Yeah, so the straps face towards the
outside. Okay, that's right. Okay, well let's give this a shot.
All right, so you just stand up and then you just walk.
And I stepped right out of that one. All right, I'll try this again. The left one was going so well. Take three. And so tell me a little bit about the trails we'll be walking on.
Sure. Well, we'll be walking on what's called our Tamarack Trail. That's one of the farthest loops to the south side of our park. It takes us close to our sugar maple grove, where we harvest sap for maple syrup in the springtime. It'll take us through some pine trees. And one of the things I really like about this trail is because it's farther away, it's a little less traveled, and we tend to see a little bit more wildlife back there. They feel a little more comfortable, feel a little more secure since they see less traffic.
These take a little bit of getting used to.
They do.
Interesting sensation.
Yeah, well, I'll be honest with you. Usually we snowshoe when there's more snow on the ground. Usually 4 to 8 inches would be a good minimum. But since we have a good ice coat under this powdery snow on top, the crampons do have something to dig into and help us keep from slipping at least.
And so is this the sugar maple grove we're in now?
It is. All the trees you see around you are sugar maple trees. Most of them are either quite large or very, very small, which is unusual, but it indicates that this is not a very it's not a very managed maple grove. We don't cut down the trees and selectively decide which trees will grow and which trees won't.
Can you talk to me about some of the wildlife that you might see out here in winter? I mean, when you think of hiking for wildlife, you think of going in the summer and mm-hmm. seeing all of the insects flying about and the bunny rabbits with their little babies out. But what can you see in winter?
Sure. Well, in winter, animals kind of have three options. They can go on vacation, they can sleep, or they can tough it out. And a surprising number of the animals here, I found, actually do just stay and kind of tough it out during the winter time. Here at Fenner, no matter what season, but even during winter, we see lots of deer, and turkeys especially are very common to see. We see lots of birds around our bird feeder that don't migrate. We see cardinals in particular, or tufted titmice, which are sort of small, bluish-gray little creatures, and they do have that crest on their head, kind of like the cardinal does as well. Like I mentioned earlier, we have fox here in the Nature Center, and you're not likely to see the fox, but you are likely to see signs of it being out here. Squirrels are quite common. Chipmunks, squirrels' smaller friends, are actually sleeping right now. They're burrowed under the ground. So what we really see here are some of the, I guess, the bigger animals and the animals who are more well adapted to survive in the cold.
So which animals are already packed away for the winter?
Well, there's actually two big categories for that, reptiles and amphibians. Those guys are not out in winter at all. Unlike mammals and birds, they are cold-blooded, which means that they rely on the sun, they rely on the ambient air temperature to stay warm and to have enough energy to run their metabolism. So right now, they are all hibernating. Snakes in particular, they sort of find all the other snakes in the area and den up together in this crazy writhing snake ball called a hibernacula. Frogs and toads are actually buried underground, either in mud for toads here in the forest or in the muds of the ponds.
So for the animals that do stay above ground, what are the food options?
They are quite limited. Deer right now are kind of just browsing around. Anything that they can see, anything that looks kind of edible, if there's any sort of green sticks left over, you know, wood that's not quite dried up yet, they're nibbling that right now. Turkeys are looking around for any kind of seeds or husks. Some of the dry grasses that are left standing have seeds that the turkeys can sort of forage. And then a lot of the animals that are still up are predators, animals that eat other animals. With the fox, we notice that its scat actually changes in the wintertime. In the summer, fox scat typically has lots of little berry seeds and fruits in it. And in the wintertime, fox scat is pretty dry looking. It's kind of hairy and full of bones.
Interesting. So they switch to kind of the hearty meat-based diet too.
They sure do, yeah.
Jenny Minch is the program manager at Finner Nature Center. We are out here snowshoeing around some of their trails and learning about some of the winter wildlife we have out here. So for animals, some of them are hibernating, some of them are sort of scavenging, getting what they can from the landscape. But what about plants? What does winter mean in the plant life cycle?
Sure. For plants, winter means dormancy as well. It means sleeping or hibernating, just like many animals are doing too. For many plants, many of the smaller type plants, dormancy comes in the forms of those seeds that they make in late summer or fall. And so those seeds are now resting, nestled underground, just waiting for the sun. They're waiting for the rain, and they've got all that stored energy, and they're ready to grow as soon as the temperatures are right. For bigger plants like our trees, especially like our sugar maples here where we're standing, they store their sap, they store the food, the energy they've made throughout the year down in their roots. And so their roots are dormant. They're not really doing anything. They're obviously not producing leaves right now, but that sap will start to flow upwards in the trunk and start to come back up into the branches and start to help produce more leaves in the early spring when we start to have changes in temperature, when it's warmer during the day and colder during the nighttime.
So why do they send that sap down to the roots during the winter?
Well, imagine putting a water bottle in your freezer. That water bottle is full of water. The water will expand as it freezes, and it will eventually snap or explode the water bottle. And so if that sap was still stored in the tree trunk here, when we get well below freezing, when we get to 14 degrees like we are today, that water could expand and expand and actually destroy the trunk of that tree. And so when the sap is down below the surface of the earth, the ground serves as an insulating layer and makes sure that that sap doesn't get cold enough to freeze and really expand enough to damage the tree.
So I'm wondering if you have any tips for people on winter wildlife viewing, the best times to go out and look for animals, or, you know, the best places. Should you be in a wooded area or in an open field? What are your expert tips for finding some cool winter wildlife around here?
Well, I have a really good one, actually. In winter, most animals you're not going to find out in an open field. You're going to find them in a conifer stand or a pine stand where you have those trees that still have those green needles on them. And that's for a couple of reasons. Number one, the trunks, the trees in that forested area will break the wind and provide some protection from that wind. The leaves, the needles that are still on the trees, actually provide some thermal insulation from up top. So they make sure that it doesn't get as cold in that area as it does in a more open area without those leaves and without that protection. And then because, again, of those needles and leaves as well, the snow doesn't build up quite as much in a pine stand as it does in a place like here in our maple grove where we have no leaves to protect the ground.
And so tell me a little bit about the hikes you guys are putting on all throughout this winter, I think. You've got a few different ones coming up.
Yeah, we have we're doing some snowshoe hikes this winter, about every other week. And we're actually going in the evening. We're going from 6 to 8 p.m. And so you asked earlier what was one of my favorite times. That is one of my favorite times to go. At dusk or at sundown is a really great time to view animals. Many animals are crepuscular, which means active at the dawn or dusk times of day. And so that's when you'll see most of those animals kind of scurrying about. And it's just a really special time. I find that as it starts to get a little bit darker, you become more aware of what's around you because you have to work a little bit harder to walk. You can't just blow right past. You have to actually think about what you're doing and what you're seeing.
Jenny Minch is the program manager for Finner Nature Center. We're out here on their trails doing some snowshoeing and looking for some winter wildlife. Thank you so much for taking me on this little afternoon adventure, Jenny.
You're welcome.
For Current State, this is April Van Buren. All right, now we'll go see if we can find other cool stuff.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, in 2014, federal officials investigated Michigan State University's response to campus sexual harassment and assault and ordered reforms. We'll meet two new university officials who have recently assumed leadership positions in the school's effort. Plus, a number of 2016's top concert tours will hit Michigan. Current State Scott Pohl talks with Lansing State Journal music writer Ann Erickson about a number of them. We're glad you could join us today. Don't forget we're on Twitter at KAR Current State, on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. Have a great day. We hope to see you Wednesday. This is 90.5 WKAR.